Hey, y'all, let me tell you about Gobble. All Gobble meal kits are pre-prepped. That means less work for you and less waste in your kitchen. Their meal kits include everything you need so you can save time at the store or just skip that trip entirely. I got the box in and I had three different meals. I had a Kung Pao chicken, crispy fish tacos, and a beef bourguignon, however you say it. But let me tell you about the classic beef bourguignon. Look, it came with beef pot roast and a beef broth concentrate, red wine demi-glace, cremini mushrooms, cipollone onions, mashed potatoes, baby carrots, and rosemary thyme butter. It was so easy to make. Literally like 15 minutes it took Cindy. And let me tell you something, all the dishes were fire, but this thing was like a taste explosion in my mouth. It's just unreal. We've got to spend more time together and more time doing the things we love because everything came in this one single box right to my door. So see what a difference Gobble will make for your household. Right now, they're offering my listeners a fantastic limited time deal. You get $120 off across four boxes, plus free shipping and free cookies. And let me tell you, those cookies, I ate one that was sin-baked and it was delicious. Go to gobble.com/real life. That's gobble.com/real life for $120 off your first four boxes. This offer is not available on the home site, so don't miss out. This is genius. It's taste explosions in your mouth like you never had.
At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, folks, welcome back to The Wow, the Woody Overton Window. This is episode 40 for October 28th, Monday. And I'm Mike Agavino here with Woody Overton. Woody, what's going on?
What's up, man? How's Florida?
Florida is getting there. It's getting there. Right. Now, we've got a rare sort of opportunity today. Usually we're recording on Thursdays.
Right.
And because Woody was traveling, we're recording on a Saturday. So we... Right. So we know the Yankees lost game one.
Yeah.
We know Trump did 3 hours with Joe Rogan. I don't know if you've listened to any.
I just saw that advertisement this morning, but I also know Trump worked at McDonald's.
Yes, he did. That was a week ago. That was pretty funny. Yes. Yeah. And as far as we can tell, he is the only presidential candidate in the race to have worked at McDonald's based upon.
He was there 15 minutes. He said, look, I've already worked. I hear 15 minutes longer than she did. Yeah. So,
you know, it's so crazy with these politicians, with the sophistication now with Oppo research and how many people are looking to take somebody down, that you got to be really careful what you say. And while it might be tempting and contribute to a narrative that you want the public to believe, you can't lie anymore. And this Tim Walz guy, I mean, every single bit of his life, he has taken and then stretched the boundaries of the truth to make himself look bigger and better with, whether it was his National Guard service or whether he was in China or not for Tiananmen Square. I mean, there's just all of these things where it's bullshit. And
it's going to be a hell of a thing to see next, a week from Tuesday.
Did you vote yet?
Yeah, but I'm going to. Yeah,
you're going to vote early, right?
I'm going to make sure everybody. No, I'm going to vote. I'm still registered where my big house was before. So I got to go down there to vote, and then but I'm encouraging everybody to vote. That way, you know, people want to ride and shit the next day because whoever won or didn't win, yeah, they can say whatever, right? Because it's going to be a shit show. And I will be staying up. I don't give a shit about the debates and all that, but I will have plenty of beer on ice and be watching election results.
Dude, you might be needing beer on ice for a week because I don't know that, like, you're going to know certain states like Florida, you're going to know what happened. Yeah. But a lot of these states with these funky rules and the way that they count, I mean, well, you could
I've been in training on the long term, okay. long hour drinking. So,
well, I'm glad you're going to be ready for it. So we've got something I think you folks will like today. We're going to talk about the final couple of episodes leading up to the finale of With the Benefit of Hindsight.
So, y'all, this episode will be the last one that's on what we call a Real Life Real Crime feed. The WOW stands on its own now, has its own numbers. And so we're going to be moving it in that way we're not restricted to dates and stuff like that, although I'm sure we'll be pretty consistent on what days we drop. And we're going to be moving and we'll put links on all our social media and everything else. So, you know, Aggo and I will be together bringing you the love and the pain of and continuous. So that's not going to change, but it's going to be on its own feed. So you're going to, you know, download it and like it and share and leave the reviews and everything else. It's important.
Yeah. So we're excited about that. So the WOW will have its own feed. All you need to do is go to your favorite podcast platform and search the WOW or the Woody Overton Window and begin following the show, downloading the show. And we should have a couple fresh episodes for you guys every week. And we will continue until the end here, because the end is, as we promised in the beginning, Woody, after being exposed to all of the evidence in this case, will let me know whether he believes that the administrators, Paterno, Spanier, Schultz, and Tim Curley, were guilty or innocent, and whether Jerry Sandusky
is guilty or innocent. Be more than a few, because I'm gonna come at you with some hardcore courtroom questions, victim questions, and stuff like that. And I get what you're saying and you know, the perfect storm and all the stuff with the different people, but I have some law enforcement things that I want to go. And I'm sure it'd be a little contentious, but to get back both ways and you know, confirmation bias, whatever you want to call it, from both sides. Right. But it's going to be interesting.
Well, here's one I think we're aligned on that's ripped from the headlines, if you will, the Menendez brothers.
Fuck them motherfuckers. I wanted so bad to get on and do a TikTok or something about them. And I was like, you know what? They're not even worth my time. There are millions of people that have been abused. I wouldn't say millions. There's a lot of people that have been abused who don't blow their parents in half and shit like that. And inherit a bunch of money. There's a lot of people that I put in prison that have killed people that have been abused or committed other heinous crimes that have been abused, and they're never getting out because it wasn't famous, you know, and it's just such fucking bullshit in election time and all that. And they, you know, they're pulling out. It's just no excuse. Look, just because you're 17, 18 years old and you commit a horrific crime doesn't mean you have the right to, I mean, fuck, everybody grows up some, but you still killed your parents. They didn't grow up. They're dead as fuck. Yeah. And they could have called the cops or done whatever. Now I fucking hate an abuser as much as anybody, but there's a different way to handle it.
Well, and I don't really know, and maybe you could shed a little light on this, on how these laws are written, but you know, extenuating circumstances. I mean, how do those, like, I mean, could OJ have said, look, my wife was a holy bitch who was stealing money from my bank account, who was sleeping with my best friend, matter?
It is absolutely nothing to do with it, except for these documentaries come out. I'm waiting on, that's the only reason the Innocent Project took up Scott Peterson. It's because all the documentaries had come out and shit like that. Two of the three had come out, and so they take it up, and it's a high profile, what I call an acute political emergency. And I read something about that dude's up for election or something shit like that or whatever. But there's no
going. Look, you get the DA and LA, yeah, the LA DA.
There's no fucking dispute. I don't think the prosecution ever disputed the fact that they were abused. But it's because you got a letter that comes out now.
So what happened is the first, they had separate attorneys. And so it was,
yeah,
it was two mistrials,
right,
declared on the first trial where, right, the abuse evidence was brought into play.
Right.
When the second trial took place, after Rodney King and after OJ. Right.
Also, after he wrote the book with that lady that he was talking to from the jailhouse, he was writing notes in the book, and he said it was all bullshit and whatever. So, you know, he couldn't testify. But it doesn't fucking matter. You know, his mama having blood on the bottom of her shoes means she tried to get up and walk out after she was shot. And they went outside, got more rounds to come back in and finish killing her. Fuck them.
Yeah, it was brutal. How they did it, no doubt. It was absolutely, yeah, brutal. But the second trial, the DA at the time, Garcetti, was in a really bad way in terms of getting reelected because, right, of both Rodney King and OJ. And so the judge did not allow evidence of any kind of abuse into that second trial. That was the scandal of the second trial was they couldn't present that evidence. That evidence was not, right, heard, right, in the second trial. But, and I know quite a bit about this case because I partnered with a guy by the name of Robert Rand, who was a writer at the LA Times, who was the main reporter on this story from day one. I mean, he's still on this case years later, right? But Rand got so involved with the brothers. He was visiting them both in prison often. He got to know every member of the family. It was Rand that visited the sister in Florida and who allowed him to go up into her attic, which is where he found letters that had gone from Eric to his cousin Andy. And that letter that is sort of the primary one people point to as, you know, the proof of the abuse. But the larger thing that never came out that he and I were working on was that Jose Menendez ran RCA Records. Mm-hmm. RCA Records had cut a deal with this promoter out of Puerto Rico that had put together this boy band that we came to all know as Menudo. And it was Jose who brought Menudo to the U.S. Well, Rand, and I've heard this, so this is firsthand, it's not hearsay. I've heard this interview. Rand interviewed the leader of Menudo, who had a pretty successful single career. You probably all know who I'm talking about. And that person told Rand on tape that he had been abused by Jose Menendez.
Guess what?
So
guess what? He didn't.
It doesn't matter.
He didn't shotgun Jose Menendez to death.
No, right. He did not.
Right.
No, he did not.
Exactly.
Right. So I think we're of the same mind on this. That yeah, yep, there was abuse, but that probably in a normal case that may have worked its way in, and it might have been what saved them from the death penalty and got them life without possibility of parole, but they got life without possibility of parole anyway.
Right.
And so what are we here? How much abuse is, gives you a hall pass to go,
right,
blow your mother's head off and, yeah, shoot your parents like that. So,
yeah,
but sounds like they may be walking amongst us soon. They'll probably have talk shows within the next
podcasts and all kinds of shit. Yeah.
So when they invite you on to the Menendez Brothers podcast to give expert opinion about whether they should have been released from prison, are you going to accept that invitation?
I wish those motherfuckers would invite me on. I wish they would. I'm not gonna be like these other people who chasing P. Diddy and all that shit to get a download. Otherwise, I would have done it. I would have done when it came out with TikTok or something about it. I don't have to chase the stories. I've got my own. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, speaking of one that's almost our own, I mean, obviously this is a story that many, many people know, and especially the people of the state of Pennsylvania and central Pennsylvania are intimate to, but we've gotten into some nitty-gritty details over the last 8-10 weeks here. And what I want to do today is actually take two of the latter episodes, episode 13 and episode 14. Episode 13 was called The Media. Episode 14 was called Secret Agent Man, and sort of fold those into our discussion today. Those two individual episodes, believe it or not, combined were almost 10 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's how deep this research went. That's how many interviews we conducted. That's kind of the breadth of what we felt we needed to do to prove the points that we were out to prove. And I think for episode 13, and especially here in 2024 with everything we've seen, I don't think it requires a tremendous amount of depth to talk about the media's role in this case, because we see the media's role today in everything. And I think that this was one of the first stories that, you know, showed what the new colors of the media in the digital age were going to be. That
back then I used to be like everybody else, you know, addicted to CNN or HNN and whatever before that was for Fox and all that. But and you believed everything the media said. And I learned 8 years ago, they're full of fucking shit. Right, I would literally be in the room where the motherfucker said something, and they would take the excerpts that they want to play, and that's the truth. And I just quit watching.
Well, that's exactly what happened. I mean, the model, unfortunately, for journalism that we grew up with.
Yeah.
You know, most of the time, competition does good things for industries. You know, mm-hmm. fragmentation in industry does good things for the industry and allows for specialization and you know, people developing better products and deeper choice for consumers. In the case of the proliferation of digital media for news, it has become so fragmented and chopped up that the business models are about popularity, not about truth. And Ziegler would say the coin of the realm is popularity, not truth, which is what it was for the first 100 years of journalism, right? Yeah. And this story is a perfect case in point to where the meat of the narrative was so juicy. I mean, it got clicks, it got stories read, it got videos watched, it got all of that sort of stuff. And it did it not only across the news media, but across the sports media as well. And it was just too juicy, this goody two shoes, holier than thou coach with this pristine record was covering up the abuse of young boys happening within his program for years. I mean, that's nothing more salacious than that. And everybody was just all too happy to jump on that.
Spark something uncommon this holiday with just the right gift from Uncommon Goods. The busy holiday season is here, and Uncommon Goods makes it less stressful with incredible hand-picked gifts for everyone on your list, all in one spot. Gifts to spark joy, wonder, delight, and that's exactly what I want it feeling. Hey, y'all, I ordered a super cool piece. It's a candle with a sculpture of LSU Tiger Stadium on top of it. And each officially licensed laser-cut wooden replica features up to 4 layers of detail, creating a bird's-eye view of a specific football field, seating section, and more. And every label includes your stadium's name, the team's logo, and school location. And it has a coconut, soy, vegan wax infused with sandalwood smell that creates tailgates and touchdowns scent profile, reminiscent of game day. It's invigorating like fresh-cut grass and nostalgic like smoke from a pre-game grill. In common, like the crisp autumn air of a new semester on campus. Y'all, I love it. I have it at the base of my TV, and I'm ready to watch the Tigers play on Saturday night, right? Uncommon Goods. Look, when you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. And many of their handcrafted products are made in small batches. So shop now before they sell out this holiday season. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. They have the most meaningful, out-of-the-ordinary gifts anywhere. They even have gifts you can personalize. From holiday hosts and hostess gifts to the coolest finds for kids to hits for everyone from the book lovers to diehard sports fans, Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, not the same old selection you can just find anywhere. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3 million to date. So to get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/RLRC. That's uncommongoods.com/RLRC for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. Hey, y'all. One thing I've learned in 16 years of being with my wife is that PMS and menopause are a very real deal. Thank goodness for Hormone Harmony. Hey, do you experience cravings or bloating? Do you feel a little bit down or off? Do you struggle to find comfort in your body? Do you experience bad sleep quality? Well, now it's easier to manage PMS and menopause with Hormone Harmony. Hormone Harmony supports hormonal balance and regulation. It relieves symptoms of menopause, supports cortisol, estrogen, and progesterone levels, promotes healthy weight loss and curbs carb cravings. It improves sleep quality, reduces occasional bloating and gas, and it relieves hot flashes and it relieves mood swings. Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through premenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds, and Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold, like hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, and occasional bloating and gas, or no desire to be intimate with someone, if you know what I mean. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. It has zero sugar, is gluten-free, dairy-free, non-GMO, and third-party tested. And the biggest benefit, my wife says, is feeling like herself again. And that's what women mention over and over in their reviews. And there are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code RLRC at checkout. That's HAPPYMAMMOTH.com and use the code RLRC for 15% off today.
Despite the fact that you had literally no evidence other than a narrative called a presentment being read by an attorney general, and then you had the actions being taken by Penn State that supported that narrative, but didn't have any other evidence to go on other than what was in that narrative. And so the combination of what the district attorney said happened and Penn State's reaction to what they said happened, the media all ran full bore toward this thing and blew it up into the biggest sports scandal in history. And it remained, one of the top stories for multiple years. I mean, 2 years, 3 years worth of coverage. And it's kind of amazing that the person who really broke this story, this Sarah Ganim, this recent graduate at the time from Penn State, who barely graduated from Penn State. She, in this first episode of the media, we share her, quote, talking about barely getting out of Penn State and that she's working for a local paper there. And she says that she had excellent sources, that she was able to work the phones at night and get great sources. What we know is that she was getting leaks, and they were purposeful leaks. They chose her for whatever their reasons were. They chose her to leak the presentment to. They chose her to leak the free report to. They chose her to be their face and their voice in this thing. So ultimately, when all of these national news crews come to State College, it's Sarah Ganim that they are turning to. It's Sarah Ganim's stories that are the stories that they are relaying. And you know, when you think about somebody who breaks a big story, you know, I see Wolf Blitzer under the table during the first Gulf War as being a huge part of the birth of CNN, or somebody like
one, what's his name, Dan Rather's called the president dead, Kennedy dead, and he went on to become a famous anchor. Yeah.
Or I was thinking of Chris, who does all the highlights for ESPN, who is sort of the first voice at ESPN. Right. There, you know, those people, Al Michaels, Do You Believe in Miracles? Those people becoming huge media figures following that thing that springboards them onto the national stage. Well, Sarah Ganim gets springboarded onto the national stage, and shortly thereafter, she's hired away by CNN from the local paper she's working for. And ironically, in her career at CNN, she's famous for really two things. One, that ridiculous 1971 accuser Randy Tice, where she had done the interview a year before and it was only audio, and she had left out some very key parts that make that story far less believable than it was advertised as. And second one, which Zig has some fun with in this episode, where she gets assigned to the snow desk, basically, is what they call it, is when you are sort of found to be the person you would bat ninth in the batting order, you don't get the greatest assignments. And she was the person assigned to put the parka on, go outside and talk about how much snow is on the ground, how cold it is, and what people are doing to deal with it. And there's an incident that she has on air, ironically, with Wolf Blitzer, that is sort of the last thing she does at CNN. She's caught giggling on the air to an abuse story, which, I mean, come on, coming out of what she supposedly uncovered at Penn State is pretty tough to swallow. So she leaves journalism altogether. She never writes a book. She becomes a teacher in Florida, becomes a mother, has kids. I'm not even sure if she's back teaching, but she has disappeared. So this savant who wins a Pulitzer Prize at age 23 for having uncovered this huge scandal and this cover-up and everything else is not even part of the media here in 2024. I think that's I think there's something that you can read into that. Another piece of the media episode that I think is a really fun listen, and you should listen to it, is, you know, ESPN has a significant amount of the people on their team, both on air and behind the scenes on the business side, that graduated from Syracuse, from the Newhouse Communication School inside of Syracuse. And they have many famous graduates there: Mike Tirico, Bob Costas, Marv Albert, all these sports caster legends that were part of Syracuse. At the exact same time the Sandusky scandal, the Penn State scandal, was blowing up, there was reporting coming out of Syracuse that the assistant coach, a guy by the name of Bernie Fine, from their basketball team had abused boys. And there was a tape that ESPN had in their possession for multiple years where a reporter is speaking with Fine's wife, who confesses in that interview that the story is true and that this is what he's done, et cetera, et cetera. And ESPN does not release that tape. They never do the story. And so Zig is at the first game of the 2012 college football season at Penn State. He's at the home opener in State College. So we're just 3 months removed from Sandusky being convicted in June. Now he's in State College for the opening game. And on the field is this guy, Mark Schwartz, who is the reporter from ESPN who covered up the whole Bernie Fine story. And Ziegler confronts him live about it, and it's classic. I mean, if you haven't listened to the episode yet, you have to listen to it, because it's just, you talk about the hypocrisy of ESPN, how deeply they got on this case with Penn State, how much they took the Penn State alums that were involved in their various broadcasts, Matt Millen, who cried live from the studio, and several other Penn State graduates that they utilized in their reporting. There's the former quarterback Todd Blackledge, who, you know, later comes to understand that there is no cover up, that the admins are innocent, and is it another one of these guys who's wishy washy, won't come out and say that Sandusky is innocent, but will say he deserves a new trial, that the trial wasn't fair. There's a bunch of people who do that, but anyway, the Penn State alums at ESPN are holding the company line. They're crying on camera. They're doing all of these things to condemn their alma mater, while ESPN is running blocker for Syracuse on a story where there's a lot more evidence than there was in the Penn State case. And so anyway, the episode goes really deep into individual personalities within the media that took this thing and ran with it without any evidence, and helped to blow it up and cause the panic and turn it into what it got turned into. And so I want to really focus our conversation today on the second episode, which is episode 14, which is called Secret Agent Man. And we called it Secret Agent Man because of this guy by the name of A.J. Dillon. A.J. Dillon was a second mile kid, grew up central Pennsylvania, was accepted into the program, participated in it for a number of years, became close with Sandusky and the Sandusky family. He fits into the MO with any of these others, the Aaron Fishers, the Alan Myers, the Brett Hoates, any of these folks that were on the original trial victim list. But Dillon had a very, very different perspective. And when Ziegler starts posting more and more stories, and when he teams up with Ralph Cipriani and we to do the article for Newsweek, and they are leaked the settlement documents and start sharing some of the information from the settlement documents, people start coming out of the woodwork from Lock Haven and all of these other places in central Pennsylvania, because they didn't know. I mean, these victims, other than Aaron Fisher, none of their names were out there. And so as these stories are coming out, people are like, oh my God, are you kidding? Alan Myers claims he made all his money from a trucking company, and this one claims it's from vitamins. And, you know, there's all this different stuff, but the consistency of the stories through those settlements episodes that we did of either those quote unquote victims confessing to people they were close to that their story wasn't true, or others who had a very strong opinion based upon how close they were to those people and how well they knew them and knew their lack of integrity, those people offering opinions. And really, we had everybody from the trial victims through all of these victims that were paid, the 36 in total that Penn State settled with. There's not a single story, other than maybe victim six, Zach Constas, the boy from the 1998 episode where he was held up to the shower and had the shampoo rinsed out of his hair by Sandusky. There's nobody that you can point to whose story doesn't get very aggressively ripped apart by others as you pull the evidence in. And so A.J. Dillon was struck by everything that was going on. He was reading what Ziegler was putting in his blog, and he began a Facebook relationship with Ziegler. And one day he sends Ziegler a DM and says something to the tune of, you know, I really ought to just go to Andrew Shubin, the attorney, and tell him I'm a victim. And Ziegler agrees and says, yeah, that's a great idea. Why don't you go to Shubin and tell him that you were a victim? And Ziegler's sort of kidding when he does that. And Dillon just floated it. And the next day, Ziegler receives a DM from AJ Dillon saying, it has been done. And Ziegler's like, what do you mean it has been? What has been done? And AJ Dillon tells him that he has gone and met with Andrew Shubin, who is the attorney who in total represented 9 of these victims, and told Shubin that he was a victim of abuse from Jerry Sandusky. He also tells Shubin that he's not very good with remembering details and that he would like to be able to record their sessions together with Shubin's permission so that he can reflect upon them afterward, et cetera. And so Shubin gives him permission to record each of these sessions. And Dillon goes back for his second session. Well, in the first session, Dillon on the fly has to come up with a story. And somehow he comes up with this ridiculous story that doesn't match anything we've heard from any other victim. But the story is that Sandusky picks him up and takes him to a park. That park is right behind where Joe Paterno lives. And in the middle of a path through that park, Sandusky forces AJ to perform oral sex on him. That's the story he tells Andrew Shubin when they are together for the first time. He goes back for a second meeting with Shubin, and Shubin sits him down, and we play all of this in the episode. And Shubin plays back to him what Shubin's notes supposedly are from their first meeting, except none of the original story exists. Shubin has changed the entire story. The story now occurs on Penn State campus. It's now abuse in a shower. All of the circumstances of the events have been shifted, and quite obviously shifted to move to a setting and a method where Shubin knows Penn State is going to pay. If something happened off campus in a park behind Joe Paterno's house, Penn State's not going to pay a penny for that. And the fact that AJ is already at this point now 30 years old as he's making these claims. So he's coming to Shubin in like 2016, and he's already 30 years old. So the statute of limitations is run. Penn State has paid out some people even after the statute of limitations, but they've paid out far less than the millions they were paying out to people who were within it. But the revelation to AJ at that point is, oh my God, here is this attorney who represented almost half of or a third of these victims in this case. And this guy, after just one sit down, has completely altered my story and is looking for me to affirm that that's my story, which is what Dillon does. He agrees with them. He mentions that there's the issue of what happened in the park, and Shubin says, yeah, we'll get to that later. And they never actually do. There's never any discussion between the two of them about what happened there. AJ Dillon remains a client, a patient of Andrew Shubin for 3 years. The sting operation goes on for 3 years. Shubin has a therapist that he works with by the name of Cynthia McNabb. And Cynthia McNabb worked with all of those other 8 victims that Shubin represented and is introduced into the equation with AJ Dillon. And we get to hear through this episode a number of the sessions with McNabb. And it is clear that she is a firm believer that repressed memories are real, that in traumatic circumstances, people will often forget what happened and it won't come back to them until years later. She's convinced that this is the case with AJ. AJ plays everything with her and Shubin in a, I think I was abused, but I'm not really sure. I don't remember everything. And that's what gets him into this regular cycle of therapy for 3 years. And, you know, we hear everything from Dillon saying things like, you know, I'm everything's becoming clearer and I'm pretty sure I wasn't abused. I don't think Sandusky ever touched me. And McNabb saying things back like, well, the fact that you don't think he ever touched you is proof that he did. Stuff like that is coming out of this therapist's mouth with him. And you know, as you go through it, you can see pretty clearly that the pattern, you know, utilized with AJ Dillon could be similar to the pattern used with these others that Shubin represented. Dillon becomes increasingly challenging of Shubin, argumentative with Shubin. He actually takes at one point the fact that Shubin represented that 1971, the Randy Tice guy who had that crazy story and had the Corvette with Jack Lambert on it and everything. You know, basically says to Shubin, I know that story's bullshit. You know, how do you know if you're willing to represent that guy who you know is full of shit? How do you know these other people that you're representing aren't full of shit as well? And basically Shubin's story is that he's learned to believe all victims, that he knows Sandusky is guilty because nobody would spend that much time with kids unless they were a pedophile. I mean, that's his basic stance on Sandusky's guilt, is who would actually care that much about kids to spend that much time with them? He's got to be a pedophile. And so the episode, it's lengthy. There's lots of great tape on those sessions. And, you know, it's really an inside look at how the sausage got made inside of this case. And it was really such a simple process to visualize and understand. There's Shubin. He's right in State College. He knows what's happening with Penn State. He realizes that the way to get the money out of Penn State is to have a big time Philadelphia law firm as the face of all of this. And so he works with Ross Feller Casey, the big Philadelphia law firm. They're the ones who are cutting the deals with Ira Lubert, who ascends to become chairman of the Board of Trustees and is the one negotiating all of these settlements with the victims. But he's not negotiating with Shubin. He's negotiating with his buddies at these big Philadelphia law firms. And so Shubin, in one of these sessions, sort of explains the whole racket and how it works to AJ, and tells him that, you know, the police don't really like that he's involved, that the prosecutors have given him a very hard time because the victims are remembering so much more in therapy than they told the police when the police went to them, that the police are concerned that you know, it could call into question whether those stories are actually true, because they're not the stories that were told to the cops when they originally approached these former Second Mile kids, who are now, of course, young adults. And so Shubin tells him that, and tells him that that he has the victims spend time with Cynthia. Eventually, the details emerge, that those details become part of the settlement documents, that the cases are handed over to Ross Feller Casey, that Ross Feller Casey goes and sits with Ira Lubert, and they negotiate the settlements, and that's the way the whole thing works. And so AJ is in the middle of this now, experiencing it the same way that these other quote-unquote victims experienced it. Comes forward, he has his story. Shubin alters his story to quote-unquote put it in the money. He then works with Cynthia McNabb for a long period where he says it gets pretty crazy, that he goes through so much therapy with her that for certain periods of time, he's actually wondering, you know, whether some of these memories that are being implanted are actually true, and says that eventually he just had to step back from it and do a whole lot less of it. He did around 100 sessions in total with McNabb over that 3-year period, and more than 12 individual sit downs with Andrew Shubin over that period of time to really solidify the validity of Dylan as a victim. Ziegler has Jerry Sandusky write a letter to AJ from prison. So Jerry writes a letter to AJ, very similar to the letters that he's written to many of the other victims, talking about grades in college and work ethic and all of that kind of stuff. And I love you, pal. And, you know, all the kinds of things that he would write. This goes a long way toward helping Shubin believe that AJ is a legitimate victim. And they believe it so much that it goes on for, again, 3 years.
Hey, y'all, you want to set your child up for success? Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with the subject? Is your child ahead, not getting challenged enough in class? Well, IXL Learning is an online learning program that enriches your homeschool curriculum. It offers practice in math, English, language arts, science, and social studies while adapting to each child, meeting them where they are. Plus, IXL encourages students to become curious and empowers them to choose how to learn. Look, we homeschool our son. No doubt about it. He's more of a visual learner, and we use IXL, and Cindy teaches him, and there are so many different benefits to the program. It adapts to exactly what he needs in different areas. So IXL is the perfect supplement to your homeschool curriculum. IXL offers interactive practice problems, educational games, lessons, and video tutorials for every topic you're teaching at home. It's easy to use, time-saving. Everything on IXL is organized by grade, subject, topic, and subtopic, making it simple to find activities for the exact skills you are covering. IXL offers instant feedback and explanations of new topics as kids use the program. Kids can explore any topic in any grade level. They aren't forced into a single learning path like they are on other programs. If you're homeschooling your child because they were falling behind or because they were too far ahead like our son, IXL is a great program to help them get the exact support they need. Kids love IXL's positive feedback awards and educational games. IXL is trusted by 15 million students worldwide and has proven to improve performance in over 75 scientific research studies. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Real Life Real Crime listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/today. Visit IXL.com/today to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price. And don't forget Real Life Real Crime listeners get 20% off. Y'all, we really do use this product, and it's been a godsend. Hey, y'all, let me tell you about Mochi. Mochi is a telehealth platform that connects patients seeking medication-based weight loss treatment with board-certified doctors and dietitians to help them determine the best treatment options to accomplish that goal. Mochi's program is completely virtual, meaning you can access their services anywhere in the United States and you will be meeting with their team online. You deserve doctors that listen. Mochi is dedicated to providing holistic, patient-centered care that prioritizes overall well-being with the goal of transforming how weight management is approached. Mochi Health takes a holistic approach to weight loss that includes visit with board-certified doctors, nutrition consultations, and medications delivered to your door. Science-backed medications including GLP-1s like Ozempic and generic compound versions, affordable and accessible, regardless of insurance coverage. With Mochi, their dietitians work hand-in-hand with your medication to create personalized nutrition plans that fit your lifestyle. Reach your weight loss goals with science-backed, FDA-approved GLP-1 medications and support from real doctors and guidance from registered dietitians and help with making easy and sustainable changes to achieve results. Y'all have seen this. My wife has done it. My brother-in-law has done it. One of my best friends is doing it, and it really is an amazing process that works. So get started at joinmochi.com and use code RLRC to receive $40 off. That's joinmochi.com and use code RLRC to receive $40 off and let Mochi help change your life.
AJ is a major part of the last appeal that that Sandusky's attorneys attempted that just got thrown out like 2 weeks ago, where all of the evidence from his therapy sessions with Shubin were part of that. And so, you know, you have this guy who does this undercover research with the lawyer, then takes it to the next level. And because Ira Lubert is the biggest supporter of the Penn State wrestling program, which is now the number one collegiate wrestling program in the country, largely because of Lubert's financial support of the program, AJ gets Lubert to agree to an interview with him. And there's a connection because AJ's grandfather was a wrestler at Penn State. And so he's able to leverage that into the interview. And the interview is about Penn State wrestling for about half of it. And then AJ segues into the Sandusky case. And he begins asking Lubert questions about the victims. And Lubert volunteers that the administrators were, quote unquote, great men, all of them, who made one mistake. So he's talking about covering up these sex crimes that supposedly led to the abuse of tens of kids as a mistake made by great men. If you believed in the cover-up theory of this case, I don't think you would be calling him great men. But anyway, he does that with the admins. He goes on to say that there's no doubt that that a number of the people they paid were simply on the gravy train, that their stories weren't true, and that we paid anyway, that the lawyers instructed him to pay anyway, that that Penn State just wanted to get through this thing, and so there was not any vetting of the victims from a Penn State standpoint. And he points to Sandusky being convicted and the prosecution as having been charged with vetting those victims. They're convicted in a court of law on those cases. And so it wasn't up to him to vet the victims that came forward. It was up to him to settle the cases, and he's quite sure that that there are folks that were on the gravy train. But he also says, you know, trust me, there's you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, and that that Sandusky was a bad guy, and that that, you know, that some of these cases are true. And it sort of goes back to this statement that we've made over and over again as we go through this. Point to the one victim whose story you believe. Who is the one of these 36 that have been paid that you would bet your life on was legitimately abused and their story is true? And, you know, we've at one point or another talked about almost all of the 36. We've certainly talked about the 20 or so that are the most viable of the stories. I mean, if we haven't talked about it, it's somebody who barely got paid anything because their story was so preposterous that Lubert didn't need to pay him anything and paid him like 30 grand to go away. But for the stories that were considered, you know, the most viable, we've talked about all of them, and they're just, there really isn't a one that you can't look at and, you know, challenge in a significant way. And so, this is what we do in Exit 14, and this is in Episode 14, and this is what AJ Dillon does for the story. I think he shows and makes it clear for people who think, well, you know, attorneys don't do these sort of things. Nobody would just whole cloth make up stories because the money was easy. Mm-hmm. This guy looked at it, I think, and said, well, look, the university needs victims. I'm not going to challenge why they're doing the things they're doing, but the things that they're doing are just inviting me to come forward with more victims. And so I'm recruiting as many victims as I can to come forward and collect checks from them and take my piece of it. And this is what's happening. And he's not going to stop it. He's going to enable it further. And the other guy, Andreozzi, even got more money than Shubin got, handled a couple less victims, but because he had Sebastian Payton, the guy that got $20 million, he got more money than anybody. But he had two attorneys working with two big Philadelphia law firms that were working with Lubert to get the checks from those law firms. And I think what we see with Dillon is what happened with, on both sides, Andreozzi's and Shubin's, with all of these people who came forward, who they could look at. And about the only vetting it seems the attorneys did was to validate that somebody had been a part of the Second Mile, because that was the big check mark. Were you in Second Mile? Did you, is there reason to believe you knew Jerry Sandusky or you had contact with Sandusky through Second Mile? And so Dillon could prove that. And he showed a lot of courage, a lot of guts to go in there and to maintain this thing for as long as he did, to get to the bottom of not only.
That's a long time, 100 therapy sessions and 12 sessions with a lawyer, but you know, there's shit bags in every profession. And I don't know what happened to Shubin, but hopefully he got disbarred. The guy has got him recorded saying one thing, and then he comes back and changes the narrative and all that. Fuck him. I know there's ambulance chasers out there like that, and they're passing off to their buddies at the big firm and, you know, getting those nice Christmas bonuses every year or whatever, however it works. Did they ever offer AJ any money?
Oh, what Shubin recommended was that AJ wait this out because there was something going around, I don't know if it still is, where the state might repeal the statute of limitations on abuse cases. And yeah, he didn't want to go and try and get a settlement and have to take a smaller number if the whole thing was going to be opened up. And AJ would not have done that. I mean, he would have had to have pulled the plug right there. And so he was happy to hear that they needed to put it on hiatus. And of course, he came out after that.
Right.
And so there was nothing that was going to happen with him and Shubin after the fact.
Hmm. Crazy. And Shubin's still chasing ambulances.
He's still very much there. His website still proudly talks about his representation of the victims in the Sandusky case and the role he played there. Because look, there's 98% of the planet that believes and understands the truth to be the narrative they were fed by the news media and the prosecutors in Pennsylvania. And there's that few among us who have been willing to work their way through all of this and look at the lack of evidence and look at the evolution of this case, look at the role the media played, look at the role the prosecutors played, the board of trustees, the governor, Louis Free, Andrew Shubin, Ben Andreozzi. I mean, all of this, as we come to the last episode, we really bring all of this together as, it's not a conspiracy in the sort of traditional sense of a conspiracy. This was not planned. There were portions of what happens as things evolve become planned portions of things because it becomes so obvious how to do certain things. But all of this comes together out of this perfect storm of self-interest by people with zero integrity. A governor who wants to take down a university president because that university president beat him in a PR campaign where he was trying to cut that guy's budget, and that guy supported the Democrat candidate he ran against, and Corbett wanted to get Spanier, and certain board members, including John Surma, wanted to get Paterno, and so they got handed on a silver platter by the media a way to get those two, and they got them. And once they got them, they started to learn how maybe they had gotten the story wrong because the media had gotten the story wrong. And then they worked really hard to cover their asses and protect the board of trustees away from, any potential guilt here. And that included paying $7 million to Louis Free to come do a bogus investigation to say that there was a cover up. It included everything that they did to help these attorneys attract more people to come forward and claim they were victims so that the numbers could look staggering to the public, including the 1970s stories, which, I think are in a way the most damaging of all, because they're such bullshit, yet these powerful people, Lubert in agreeing to pay something to those people, the prosecutors, including, by the way, the current governor who was almost the vice president, on Harris's ticket, Josh Shapiro, put Graham Spanier in jail. I mean, he absolutely knows and knew the truth. Everyone that's senior in Pennsylvania politics knows the truth of this story. It's the legendary case that only gets whispered about in boardrooms because the public can never know what happened here. Sandusky can never get out of prison. No one will ever admit what they did. It's a tragedy of just unbelievable proportions that, nobody can believe on the surface, because on the surface you look at it and go, hey, there are 36 victims here. This guy was tried in a court of his peers and found guilty on 45 counts. All of these things that you would normally look at to, to determine whether something's true or not. You look at it on the surface and, you know, this all passes the surface level smell test. It's not until you go deeper. And were it not for John Ziegler, I don't think anyone else would have gone deeper. And all he had was a hunch, and his gut is so good. I know from working with him so closely for the last 10 years that his gut on stories is so good that the thing that he knew was he knew that Joe Paterno was not capable of turning his back on child abuse if it was going on inside of his program. And that's the thing that got him to do.
1,000% agree with that. And what people don't understand is unless he was actively involved, and I know he wasn't, in raping kids, he would have never fucking turned his back on it. And all the rest of this being a perfect storm and people getting their vendettas out and all that shit, I get all that. There's no way you know, ever convinced me that Paterno knew anything about it. And that's, you know, that's bullshit. So you've proven that point. But we still got to get to, you asked about the one of the 36. But when we do the other episodes, we'll get into the, you know, the shit that nobody wants to talk about. The courtroom testimonies of the rapes and stuff like that. I agree with you. All the rest of this and the attorney's line and the attorney general coming out and that fucking douchebag, McQuarrie, the coach and all that. I agree with you on that. And Paterno got fucked and as well as the rest of them. And certainly people took advantage of it. The media took advantage of it. And then, yeah, the other people who had different agendas took advantage of it. Everybody from lawyers to the, you know, the guy that was the governor or that's the governor now or what have you. But the, you know, the facts of the case are the Sandusky's case, not this. But I agree with you on all this. The fact, and I agree that, you know, that some, if not most of those victims are lying. But we can get into the hardcore shit when we get done with the next episode.
Awesome. Appreciate your open-mindedness on this. I mean, I know when we started,
I don't have a problem calling a spade, but I do have some issues with some of this victim shit and not all of it, but I needed to deep dive into it when I'm sitting on a deer stand and, the latest petition and everything else. But I send it to you. They write their opinion why they say Sandusky is still guilty as fuck. And why the appeals basically it lists what happens. And then it said confirmed judgment sentence in part and vacated his restitution sentence requiring his payment of $95,000, explained the limited reprimand, blah, blah, blah. And it goes in, it'll break down point by point and tell you how Sandusky's challenging it and how they're denying it on each and why they're denying it on each cost. So,
well, I'm very, very interested to read that, but I think agree with me that what this case is, as you dig into it versus what we were all led to believe, what we've walked around thinking was the case here is night and day.
Totally agree that it was a perfect storm on so many different fronts. And it's such a perfect storm that it makes it hard to believe that there were any actual victims, but we'll get into that because just because everything else in the media ran with it and all got blown up and this and this and this and this happened. And for, you know, people take advantage of situations, do things for their own reason. It doesn't mean that somebody wasn't telling the truth, but and I'll look at it and we'll talk about it. So
awesome. Well, hey folks, remember starting next week, it's the WOW, the Woody Overton Window on Apple, Spotify, all the places you usually go for your podcasts. Yep. And What do you got some news to share about Real Life Real Crime, right?
Yeah. Real Life Real Crime, hashtag justice for the first episode is going to be named Haley for right now. And this case, it's just unbelievable, y'all. And it's being done in a way that I've never done a case before because of the video and audios and everything that I have. And we're going to get justice for this family. I'm also going to be, I'm bringing everything back on Real Life Real Crimes feed. We're not going to be doing the daily show anymore. I am going to be doing a show that we've been in the works on adding to it, but it's going to be a segment of the daily show, not the daily show. It's going to be a segment of original Real Life Real Crime called True Crime Time for Blank. Right. And we're going to bring you a lot of shit on there and it'll be fire. So, and then, the Daily Show rides off in the sunset as sometimes happens. And that's just the way business shit works. Right. All right. So love and appreciate each and every one of y'all. Can't wait to see you on the new feed. And look, when we say that, I don't think people understand how important reviews are, Mike, whether you like it or don't like us. We fuck up your day. You want to go and do it. Go and leave a review and, validates what we do. And it also helps other people find the show and whatever algorithms they use. So it's very important. And I'm going to be pushing that because I want to read your reviews. And I know there's a lot of aglets out there, right?
Well, and look, whether you listen to heckle or you listen because you enjoyed the show, we appreciate you listening and hope that you will continue to listen on the new feed. And Woody, thanks for everything you've done. Yep. It's always fun doing this and looking forward to doing a lot more. So
awesome.
Thank
bro.
You folks.
All right. I appreciate it. All right. Till next time on the new feed. Peace.
Aglets.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Mmm, boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? Mmm, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.